You are listening to the Screen Slate Podcast. I'm your host, John Derringer, and on this episode, we are thrilled to welcome back to the couch at Screen Slate HQ, Clyde Folly, curator of the Criterion Channel's 90s horror series. In this series, back to talk about gems in the new collection, including Demon Knight, Death by Temptation, The Rapture, and more, along with just the general nuts and bolts of what it's like to program for a streaming channel. We also have some channel-related giveaways, so check our newsletter and social channels for that information. Also, if you are in New York City, be sure to check out our own horror series, Death Takes a Holiday, at Roxy Cinema Tribeca. We're doing it in conjunction with the writer and artist Christopher Norris, aka Steak Mountain. We have some really cool deep cuts coming up that includes Laurel Nakadati's lynchy neo-realist feature, The Wolf Knife, and also The Shining, as you'll hear later in this episode. Which is going to be shown on 35mm in an actual hotel. It's going to be like, you know, VR experience. So visit our website for information about that. Final thing, as always, I want to give a huge, hearty shout out to our Patreon members that make Screen Slate possible. I'm not just talking about the podcast, but our city-specific showtime listings, daily editorial, and more. Screen Slate is basically a labor of love, and our Patreon supporters enable us to pay writers and editors honoraria, maintain our daily newsletter, pay for web development and hosting, and more. So visit patreon.com/screenslate to sign up. And without further introduction, here's Clyde.
All right. We are here in Screen Slate HQ, back with our returning co-host, Caroline Gollum.
Hi.
Not pictured this episode, Jonathan Klaxman.
R.I.P.
You got the, what was it called again?
The Marburg virus?
Yeah. The 5G alert.
Can't believe it.
Came and Clax just dropped.
he was called home to his home planet.
So we're back at Screen Slate HQ. It's been a minute since we did like a pod here with me and Caroline and Clax, who's not here, but I guess is in spirit. And returning to the couch is our good friend, Clyde Folly. You are the curator of the 90s horror series on the Criterion Channel. You also curated 80s horror last year, and there was 70s horror the year before, right?
Yes, which it was a couple years before, and I contributed to that one.
Okay, yeah. So tonight we wanted to talk about your series, 90s horror. We wanted to talk about some of the other horror stuff on Criterion. And then we're also going to, you know, do a segment on Unfriended, which is a movie that's very near and dear to us at Screen Slate, which we'll get into later. But why don't we start by talking about 90s horror? I was going to ask what inspired the series, but I guess it's, you know, 70s, 80s, and then
chronology inspired it.
Time.
Just giving the people what they want.
Yeah. But it's really eclectic. I mean, each time you curate a series like this that represents an entire decade, and again, you co-curated the 70s one, and you did the 80s one. How do you try to encapsulate the entire decade when you're making these kinds of curatorial decisions?
Well, first of all, I want to say, like, none of these series would be possible without the programmer of the Criterion Channel. Without Penelope Bartlett, the 70s and 80s horror would not be possible. Without Aliza Ma, who is the Criterion Channel programmer right now, 90s horror would not be possible, nor would any of these other series that are up on the channel right now. And I just want to make sure to shout out Aliza for her tremendous work that she does day in and day out. It's a lot of work programming for a streaming service.
Well, it's also like other streaming services don't have the same thing where things are in thought out, considered series. I mean, there are other ones like, you know, just to shout out, like Ovid TV, for example, has really thoughtfully put together series. But generally on like a Netflix or a Hulu, or, you know, shout out to Tubi, they're not, you know, grouped into series. It's more like they're gathered in some algorithmic genre category, like, you know.
Well, they used to be a lot more niche, though. Do you remember that this was an ongoing meme when Netflix first launched its streaming service? They would have, you know, period dramas with a strong female lead.
Right. Mind-bending, psychological.
Taut psychological thrillers. What's another one? Like, grown-up comedies, I think is like a, or, but it would be grown-up comedies.
Just to say, like, with Criterion, it's like, you know, it's like an actual series.
No, there's real programming behind all these series at the Criterion Channel.
Yeah. You know, and also even when you're curating any kind of series, or we could use the more blue collar term, programming. that's what I'm not a curator, John. I'm a programmer.
Yeah.
You know, you're dealing with things like rights and print availability and all kinds of, I guess you could say, hurdles or challenges or parameters. And so I can imagine too with streaming that is even more so the case, because you're dealing with like who has rights to what and which service has a exclusive window. And
no, that's absolutely correct. It is. I think that's the defining difference between programming for theatrical and programming for streaming. And I think that really became a unique challenge for 90s horror. I feel like with this series, there were a lot of films I was looking at, and then there were a number of films, I think more so than 80s horror, that, you know, we're told that they weren't available because of these very things you're describing.
And it's become very Byzantine too, you know, like the tracking down of who owns what in a lot of ways, like, shuffles constantly. And like, if you're dealing with a specific object that needs to arrive somewhere at a certain time, you know, and you're securing the permission to show this thing one time or several times, that's one thing. It's another when it's an easily replicable image that is like able to be dispersed across the internet, but only certain people have permission to distribute it through a certain channel at a certain time. And then that permission changes, like, sometimes regularly, sometimes it just shifts, sometimes it falls, you know, into a weird like liminal ether.
Yeah.
It's stuff that's easily replicable too, right?
And it's all like artificial.
But it is an interesting thing to think about. Like, all of these movies that we're talking about that are programmed in this series or any series are things that, you know, we would go and find and seek out, like, as a material thing, or you'd go and have it served to you. Now there's the buy-in of, like you said, this packaging or this curation versus downloading it, for example, or finding a rip on some other thing. You know,
I would never do that.
No, of course, you wouldn't steal a car. I mean, I know I wouldn't. I would never download a movie either. But sure. I mean, but there are plenty of people who do, you know.
Yeah. Criminals.
Sure. Low, low lives. The worst kind of person imaginable. Someone who would download a movie.
Yeah. But for the 90s, I mean, I'm sort of curious. Like, I feel like in some ways more recent things can be more difficult to program. I don't mean very recent things, but like, let's say 20 years ago, maybe that makes me sound old to be like, no, you know, kind of recent, like 20 years ago. But like
20 years ago is after the series that we were talking about initially, too. Like, it's even longer ago than that, you know.
But things fall into this weird limbo, and it can be, you know, surprisingly difficult sometimes to sort out these like rights and questions. I'm sure this is super exciting for horror movie fans.
I know. I think like people are interested in this, though, because I talked to people like randomly, you know, and who are like, oh, I want to put a series together, and how do I do it?
Right.
And I'm sure you talk to people about this, and you talk to people about it too. Like, anybody who's ever done it is suddenly able to impart this, whatever little knowledge they've gained in the practice, onto somebody else. Right.
And it, like, it doesn't take place in a vacuum at all.
No.
Like,
and people are curious to know.
Yeah.
They want to know how the sausage gets made.
And then also you have to think, you know, so that's even beyond the conceptual level or what people might typically think of as curation. But you're also thinking, yeah, again, you want to balance this concept or point of view you're trying to put across. But you also have to think about the audience. Like, I think about the audience, or if we're doing something at a venue and the venue's fronting a lot of the costs, I'm thinking about, like, I don't want to bankrupt them by just showing like the most esoteric, expensive, zero appeal films, you know? So like, we're doing the series right now, this horror series at Roxy Cinema called Death Takes a Holiday, and it's kind of travel themed horror. And of course, like, within seconds of the series being announced, someone was like, oh, The Shining. And it, you know, it's a friend of mine who might be listening to the pod, you know, no disrespect, but it's just like, that's the thing where it's like, yeah, like, you, if you don't put The Shining in the travel horror series, someone is going to be like, where's The Shining? If you do put it in, someone's going to be like, The Shining.
People are always going to come with suggestions, because this is what I mean when I say they're interested in this esoteric facet of it and how the sausage gets made. Because anybody who, not anybody, but a lot of people who love movies and watch them with the rigor that we watch them are thinking, what would I do? if I had a way to show people, to pick movies and show them to people.
Yeah.
In much the same way that music heads become DJs. I don't think there's a vast difference between the two. If you love something very passionately and you're very devoted to it, you're going to think, there's other people that are going to love this. Or I got to figure out a way to attract with a homing beacon the other freaks that like this weird thing too.
Right.
I mean, I was going to add to this and add to what John is specifically saying about commenting on the things that are missing, that are perhaps canonical films.
Scream.
Which I haven't seen it.
It would never occur to me in a million years that Scream would be in the series, but I'm sure there are people who are like, you did 90s horror without Scream.
I mean, the thing is, Scream is an important film to talk about when talking about what happened in the 90s. Absolutely.
For sure. Yeah.
And I was thinking about this very thing earlier today when I was on All of It with Allison Stewart, the radio show that I was on.
Where can we hear that, by the way?
It's on WNYC. They believe that there is an archive episode that's probably up by now.
Oh, excellent. I can't wait to hear it.
Thank you. But what I was going to say is that we're taking calls and Allison was getting text messages from listeners. And
Ghostface? Did Ghostface call?
No one called and asked what my favorite scary movie was. But something that Allison pointed out late in the segment was that a lot of people are calling in or texting and saying their favorite 90s horror movie, and Seven and the Blair Witch Project kept coming up over and over. And you know, I think what I said at the time and where I still stand is that, you know, I like those movies, and Blair Witch especially is a very important film when talking about what 90s horror is. However, from where I stand from a programming perspective, I think that most everyone knows about the Blair Witch Project and they don't need me to tell them about the Blair Witch Project.
Yeah.
And that is a programmatic approach that for you is based on like a certain amount of discovery. Whereas another inroad to it, the people that are going, why no Shining? Why no Scream? Why no? Not to denigrate.
Shining's from 1980.
Whatever. I'm using it as an example, John.
Do you even like movies?
I actually hate them, but they rule my life.
I hate
so
them at this point,
I can
too.
Do.
Yeah.
The people that are going for the top of the food pyramid, like the brand recognition titles, are thinking about something in a canonical way.
Which is a way of thinking
about it.
That's
a way, that's an approach.
Yeah.
The popularity of something also, like The Godfather being a great example, seems to imply in the public trust that it should just be available like on every label or in every format or on every platform too. Like why wouldn't it be? There's like a disconnect.
The people should own The Godfather.
Well, yeah, I think so. But yes,
The People's Godfather.
The People's Godfather. But that's the thing is that people
love it. Well, that's what Tubi's for.
You can watch, I'm pretty sure you
it's
can
like
watch The
Tubi,
Godfather.
There's probably a movie called like The God Space Father. And
The God and the Father.
And we love Tubi for it.
Yeah, I mean, let's talk about some of the stuff that's in the series, because I'll just bring up a title that I think is really major and probably my favorite film of all the ones in the series is Tales from the Crypt Presents Demon Night. And the reason I want to bring that up when we talk about stuff like Scream is, you know, I think there's kind of this at a distance if you're thinking about the 90s, it's kind of like this wasteland of not a lot of great studio films. And then you have Scream, which comes in from Miramax and kind of kickstarts like the teen slasher, you know, almost in a way kind of throwback slasher phase. And then you have Blair Witch, which kind of bridges into the next decade. So something like Tales from the Crypt Presents Demon Night is kind of outside of that. It's almost like an anomaly. And I think it's been kind of an overlooked film. I mean, obviously, people who love horror movies know about this film, but I think it's just like one of the major horror films, period, and certainly of that era. And also probably the best, you know, mainstream studio produced horror film of the decade.
High praise.
Yeah. I would throw down that gauntlet. I mean, I don't know what else.
Well,
yeah.
No. I mean, I'll say this about Demon Knight, which is that growing up in the 90s as a kid, I was a huge Tales from the Crypt fan.
Yeah, same. Really. Yeah.
And we didn't have cable And so I was watching like the syndicated episodes on Fox, which was like, I think I was watching like Simpsons reruns and then Tales from the Crypt. And, you know, I was in heaven in those early evenings. And so I remember being super pumped for the big screen Tales from the Crypt movie.
Oh, hell yeah.
I saw it as soon as it came out on video because my father would not take me to go see it.
I can't remember if. Trying to remember if I saw it in the theater at the time. I would have been like 10 or 11. But if I can imagine, I was probably so fucking annoying about making my parents take me to see it that maybe they did. But I can't remember if I saw it in the theater or on VHS initially.
This is an aside, so I'll try to make this as quick as possible. I remember also renting Tales from the Crypt Presents Bordello Blood
as
that came out. And also, I was not prepared for how inappropriate that is for a child.
Yeah. And also just not to mention just like terrible.
It's terrible.
Irredeemable. I'm sure someone somewhere is like, actually Bordello Blood is the worst fucking movie.
The Bordello Blood reclamation does not begin here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But like it's funny because that was like my most anticipated movie of all time before it came out because I loved Demon Knight so much.
Because you love Dennis Miller that
much. And then, you know, I had no concept of like you have essentially pretty different people making the sequel. You know, I didn't know that. I think a lot in retrospect too, when I watch it now, a lot of what I respond to about Demon Knight is the direction by Ernest K. Dickerson, who is also just generally, I think a pretty underappreciated director. You know, for people who are unaware, he is kind of maybe ostensibly best known as the cinematographer on a lot of the famous Spike Lee movies, like Do the Right Thing and stuff like that. But he's also directed some really incredible genre films, like, you know, aside from Demon Knight, he did Surviving the Game, which I assume is a favorite of yours.
Oh, I like Surviving the Game very much.
It's like Most Dangerous Game with Ice-T and
Rucker Hauer and
Gary Busey.
F. Murray Abraham, he's in Surviving the Game, right?
It's just like every actor you would want to be in a movie like that is in it, and it is so fucking sick.
It basically delivers on the promise of what you want this kind of movie to be when you go to the video store in 1994.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And he did
Bones, he did Juice.
Yeah.
He did
Bulletproof. Is that the name? Bulletproof, yeah. Which I watched at some point, and I remember I think he kind of disowns that movie. Like, he talks about how it was a terrible experience, but you can definitely see, you know, again, not to be like the Bordello of Blood Rocks guy, but like you can definitely see moments of, I would, yeah, maybe even say like greatness in that film. Like, there are some really cool like crane shots and stuff. You can tell he's kind of popping off at certain points.
I haven't seen it since I was a kid, but I did own a tape of Bulletproof, and I definitely watched it a bunch because of how much I loved Sandler and Damon Wayans at the time.
Yeah.
And so seeing these guys in a buddy action movie when I'm like 11 years old is very cool, but I've not revisited it since.
Yeah, it's like a movie that should be better than it is, but it's not like, yeah, I wouldn't like totally write it off.
No, but as like a studio filmmaker, Ernest Dickerson is a very interesting guy. He makes these good. He also did, what's the DMX movie he did? Never Die Alone.
And it's crazy too, because it was shot on like 16mm, and it's like I don't know if it was a straight up studio film, but I remember that showed in theaters everywhere. Like, you could go to your local multiplex.
I'm remembering
and see
correctly,
that.
Right?
It's
that
kind
is
of
Dickerson?
A gnarly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And he's like, he's one of like the few black studio genre filmmakers at this time. One of the few people of color who are afforded the chance to make genre films at this level. And there's often something of interest in these films.
Yeah. But you can also see, I think, in that film. So for people who don't know about this film, and I won't get into like spoiler territory, although I don't even really know how much you could like spoil it, but like, it's about this, it's totally standalone from anything having to do with Tales from the Crypt. That's just kind of the framing thing. The Crypt Keeper introduces it. But it's about the background is there's this age-old conflict between like the followers of Christ and demons, and there's this hotel in the middle of nowhere in, I guess, New Mexico, where William Sadler is this wanderer who shows up. And this sheriff-like figure is chasing him. And, you know, you're sort of set up to think like William Sadler is the bad guy and the sheriff is the good guy. But of course, very quickly, the tables turn and William Sadler is holed up in this, you know, flea bag hotel with all these random people. I guess you could say it's almost sort of like Hawksian or something, because they've used the blood of Christ and this key to like seal the demons out. So then the Titanic Billy Zane guy is, you know, trying to get, I don't know, whatever, blah, blah, blah. It's basically like they're in this flea bag hotel, like sieged by demons.
Yeah, I mean,
it's Rio Bravo. John Carpenter says every movie is Rio Bravo.
Yeah.
This is a Rio Bravo.
Look, I think, I don't know, as I get older, if my brain is just rotting or is just too damaged at this point, but it's like I find myself leaning less on the importance of plot these days. And I think it's, with a movie like Demon Knight, it's like, it essentially boils down to, it's a siege movie. It's like a Hoxian Carpenter-esque siege movie of these people trapped in this hotel, surrounded by demons, and how are they going to get out? And it's very, it's like, it's lean, and it is just so like focused on the dangers of the moment in that like Hoxian Carpenter way.
But it also just has incredible set pieces. It's like great fucking set piece after great fucking set piece. And if you compare it to something like, I think maybe an obvious point of comparison with Carpenter would be something like Prince of Darkness. And I know people love Prince of Darkness and might think this is like heresy to say, but like Demon Knight like whips the shit out of that movie in terms of just like like Prince of Darkness has a lot of great scenes in it that you kind of, these indelible images you remember, but like every fucking moment of Demon Knight just like rips so fucking hard.
Well, only one of these films features Billy Zane.
Exactly. And you know, as a Greek American, you know, I've got to give it up for Billy Zane. The other thing too, I saw today, there was like Hollywood Reporter put out this list of like the 100 greatest film books that was through some kind of like aggregated list of, you know, whatever.
There's a list out now?
It's a new listicle, 100 greatest film books. All I was going to say is my number one would be the Fangoria special issue that was dedicated to Demon Knight. And like,
ahead of like James Agee's writings.
Yes. Yeah. Manny Farber. Film was a subversive art.
Pervert's Guide to Cinema.
Kevin Brownlow.
Yeah.
No, the best. It's not
Thompson
even,
and Bordwell, bottom of the list. For
I mean,
you,
unless
one.
People want to disqualify it as a magazine, I would say the Fangoria special issue about Demon Knight is the best film book ever made because it has so many cool, gory pictures.
If TV shows are movies now on people's lists, then magazines are books now.
Yeah, Fangoria is the book.
Can I share some historical context on Tales from Crypt Demon Knight for a moment?
Absolutely.
Because look, a lot of times when it comes to putting these series together, it's almost like I come up with the list. I figure out like what movies I think we can get, and which sometimes is different from what the actual list ends up being. And then once we have the films, it's almost like, okay, then I really have to figure out like, wait, what did happen in the 90s? I think one of the things that happened in the 90s is that I think TV, specifically cable TV, became more of like a venue for horror, because in like the late 80s, early 90s, like theatrical distribution, like was really started like collapsing a bit. Like a number of theaters closed, a number of studios went under. The example I keep pointing to is by the time that Silence of the Lambs won all the major Academy Awards, its studio Orion was already bankrupt and it could not save Orion. And something that I noticed while going through a lot of films in the 90s is that Universal specifically was making a number of films for cable television. In addition to producing Tales from the Crypt, Universal also ends up being the studio ultimately behind Fred Walton's When a Stranger Calls Back. They also produced Toby Hooper's I'm Dangerous Tonight.
And,
and Frank Darabont's Buried Alive.
Wait, did you try to get Dangerous Tonight for the Criterion series?
I considered it. I definitely watched it.
It's on YouTube.
You denied the Criterion viewer.
Well,
it's widely available, though.
It's not widely. It's one of those things where a number of these Universal cable TV movies are not so easily streamable.
Oh, like what's the H.P. Lovecraft, Dennis Hopper one? Witch Hunt?
Cast a Deadly Spell? Or Witch Hunt is Witch the Hunt. Dennis Yes. They're both.
They're both Lovecraft movies?
One is like a sequel to the other.
Witch Hunt is like an H.P. Lovecraft adjacent.
It's like a Dashiell Hammett slash Lovecraft mashup.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's a 90s does 40s or 50s neo-noir about H.P. Lovecraft and the Witch Hunt.
Yeah.
As a concept. But it was a cable movie.
But the original one was with Fred.
Cast a Deadly Spell, right?
Yeah. Fred Tremors.
Fred Ward.
Fred Ward? Yeah.
Fred Tremors.
I have not seen Cast a Deadly Spell probably since 1996.
Is it good?
Witch Hunt.
Should I check it out? Witch Hunt is not great.
I don't remember being crazy about either of these movies.
Bummer. Cast a Deadly Spell is fine. It's cool.
Uh-huh.
It seems like such a high concept.
But there were so many of these like major studio like cable TV horror movies around this time. And I think that this ends up being like a thread.
Do you think there's something about the horror genre that like something innate in the genre though that lends itself to a kind of Freudian making process, because you're talking about a period in time when studios were making these movies for television that were ostensibly meant to be like lower budget or at least like profitable for them enough to sell on cable and make that way or direct to video. And now there's like highly specialized streaming services specifically for horror movies. And there's like a whole cottage industry. And even earlier when we were talking about our friend, the author who writes horror novels, this is like an incredibly popular genre that people can work at and be like highly productive in. And I'm curious to know what either of you think about whether the genre is like, there's something about it that makes it so replicable. Is it the tropes? Is it the way that you can reorganize those tropes? Is it that people love being scared and there are a million ways to scare people? Like what, you know? Because it's always been like, and it was like that in the 60s too.
I feel like it's the simplest answer is people love being scared.
Yeah, yeah.
You can make horror movies for cheap.
And it sucks when a movie's not scary or gory. It could be one or the other or both.
They're unwatchable. And
yeah. I'm like, what am I doing here?
There's no blood. There's no gore. And it's not scary.
Or have like great vibes. For instance, you know, if we want to shout out briefly, like the Pre-Code series on Criterion right now.
Pre-Code Horror.
So there's 90s horror, Pre-Code Horror. There's also high school horror, which we're going to talk about in a minute.
There's art house horror.
And I feel like Criterion's kind of like gunning for Shudder this month, which is great also because I feel like historically, New York-based film programmers like ignore horror, you know. For many years that it was like October would come around and it would be like nothing.
No, I remember, you know, last year in like 2022, it was just like the summer of 2022, Lincoln Center had the Argento series, MoMA had this like 100 film horror series in like the middle of July.
Oh yeah, it's really weird. Yeah.
And then October rolled around and there was literally nothing. There was not a single scary movie.
I don't think we even did, because like a lot of times we try to do like a horror screenslate.com tries to do a horror series, and I don't think we did last year.
You did one last year, no? At Roxy, I feel like you did.
We did maybe the year before. Well, we barely even scraped 90s horror. I just want to mention.
I have a list of movies that I've talked about.
Well, I mean, Ernest Dickerson, just to, you know, kind of segue into another film, was the cinematographer on James Bond III's Death by Temptation, which is another film that I think is kind of started to get its due after many years. This is a film that was originally released by Troma. I actually had the Troma VHS, and like one for better or worse would never really think of a Troma film as being in any way like reputable, but yeah, I mean, it's an incredible film. Like
You know what's funny about this movie and in my life, you know this about me, that I used to work at Troma. It was the first real job I ever had in New York. I spent a year working at Troma. but I did not see Death by Temptation until about 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And when I finally saw it, I was like, how did I sleep on this movie?
Yeah.
It's so good. It's so funny. It's at times it feels like it's two different movies, right? Because there's like the main plot of the film, which is about these two guys, one of whom, they're both from North Carolina originally. I think they might in fact be cousins. We're talking about Kadeem Hardison and the film's writer, director, producer, James Bond III.
I believe also did some of the music.
Did he do some of the music?
Yeah. In fact, I think he has kind of like a record recording background.
I didn't, because I knew he was a child actor.
Yeah.
But I didn't know he was a musician. It's got a great soundtrack.
The Ultimate Renaissance Band. Yeah. I mean, the entire soundtrack, all the like needle drops on it are great.
Nothing but solid R&B bangers.
Yeah. And it's set in...
It's all
like Bed-Stuy, Clinton Hill area.
It's all like within four blocks of my apartment in Fort Greene.
Yeah.
Like, it's basically, it's like the bar in Death by Temptation is right next to Alibi.
Actually, Cosmo wrote a piece about like the locations of Death by Temptation on Screenslate.com. So if you Google Screenslate.com, Def, D-E-F by Temptation, Cosmo, Bjorkenheim.
Bjorkenheim.
Yeah, it'll autocorrect.
Okay, and cool.
It'll come up. This article.
It should pop up the minute you type in screenslate.com, actually.
Yeah.
But also to place Death by Temptation within like the historical context and going back to like the themes of what even like 90s horror, I think, is all about. I think one of the developments of the decade is that Black people came back to horror in both in front of and behind the camera.
Mm-hmm.
Because early 90s is concurrent with New Black Cinema, mm-hmm. and Death by Temptation in particular has a lot of connections to Spike Lee's School Days. And like basically the entire cast was in School Days, including.
Yeah. And of course, the cinematographer.
And,
yeah.
And the cinematographer.
But yeah, like Bill Nunn is in it.
Bill Nunn, who is basically spends the majority of the movie sitting at a bar and really badly attempting to pick up women, including at one point by claiming he's the new singer of Cameo.
Wow. What a specific.
It's a great fucking film. And it looks
like a Mario Bava movie.
Yeah, yeah. But it was kind of marginalized, you know, in the sense that it didn't get, I mean, not to like disparage Trauma, but like it didn't.
I mean, it's not a knock to say that Trauma is not a major studio. I remember I was listening to the commentary track on the Vinegar Syndrome Blu-ray of Death by Temptation, which you probably have. I don't know if you've ever listened.
I think for some reason, have like three, like I bought it three times, forgetting that I owned it at various points. You know, they do like the sale, and I don't actually watch DVDs. I just buy them or Blu-rays. See, now I'm an old person where I call everything a DVD, even if it's not. Like, yeah, I got all these DVDs. But yeah. Now people are going to think I'm rich because I bought like three copies of a movie.
You put me in mind of something just now when you were talking about the return of Black directors and performers to the horror genre, which is that this, maybe it's by dint of fact that you're going chronologically, but that the series seems to be a little bit more heterogeneous in the makeup of directors than other iterations of it.
It's an interesting thing to consider. I mean, it's something I was thinking about, like while I was doing 80s horror, one of the questions that I had was like, where did all the Black filmmakers go? Because in like the 70s, you know, even like outside of Blaxploitation, there are just a number of like Blaxploitation adjacent movies like Ganja and Hess, which is all time banger, Ganja and Hess. And, you know, Bill Gunn was not, well, it wasn't really working in horror in the 80s, but it's just that these movies weren't being produced and financed at the rate that they were in the 70s. And it was just a question that I had while doing 80s horrors. Where did all the Black filmmakers go? And then basically what Death by Temptation is 1990. It's just like they probably went into production in the late 80s on that. And so it starts coming back. And then you get films like also Tales from the Hood, Candyman.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
People Under the Stairs, which is a fantastic film.
Oh, yeah. I like People Under the Stairs very much.
Yeah. But I think it's kind of interesting, too. I mean, this is maybe even just kind of a stray observation, but something like Demon Knight, it wasn't like part of the marketing or like, well, you wouldn't have known it was directed by a Black filmmaker if you didn't research the film. And it, like, I don't even think IMDb existed. So like, unless you knew who Ernest Dickerson was and kind of put it together, it wasn't, for instance, today it would be, I think, like, that would be part of the kind of narrative around the film is like, this is by a Black filmmaker. And when you watch the film, that is, I think, very much part of it, but it's not something you would necessarily consciously pick up on if you watched it when it came out in, you know, 1995 or whenever.
No, no, I agree with you on that. And I think it's almost, you know, in a way, it's also, it's almost addresses race in the way that, like, the George Romero movies will address race, and that, like, it's not ever really, like, explicit about it, or it just happens to have, like, very strong and very interesting, very complex Black characters in the film.
Yeah. And it's also, again, this isn't something that's explicit or manifest in the film, but Jada Pinkett, Pree Smith, her character does read as kind of queer, you know, in the same way that characters in films like, you know, Set It Off, et cetera, do. And also the fact that her character, I get, maybe this is low key kind of a spoiler, becomes kind of like a Christ figure is, I think, very kind of a radical statement that they're making in the film. It's like this, like, queer Black Jesus, like, kind of character in the end. So, I mean, there's definitely, like, a lot of interesting stuff going on there that wouldn't necessarily have, like, read to a mainstream audience, or, like, people wouldn't be primed by any kind of, like, marketing hype to be thinking about this kind of stuff.
No, no, they're absolutely just thinking this is the Tales from the Crypt movie, and it has the Hey Man, Nice Shot in it.
Yeah, and boobs.
It has a lot of them, doesn't it?
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, that's also what's kind of incredible about this film is I feel like we've just been talking too much about this film, but like, it really delivers on like the 12-year-old boy, like, you know, Tales from the Crypt, which was kind of the vibe of the HBO show, while doing a lot of like other really interesting stuff that I think has flown under the radar. And I also think too, is people have kind of tried to reappraise and rediscover and reevaluate films by Black filmmakers, that this one, you know, I think maybe for kind of obvious reasons, still like doesn't get the cred or like the reputation that it probably deserves because it is like the Tales from the Crypt movie.
Well, it's, you know, when the series was announced, shout out to our dear friend Hillary Weston, who is the director of social media for Criterion. One of the things that she told me on like the day the series announced was people are very excited about Demon Knight. It was like the most like discussed movie that day. People were like, yes, Demon Knight. People are very excited about it. And so I don't know. I feel like what you're describing, this sort of like reclamation, reassessment of Demon Knight, I think is already well underway.
Yeah. It's overdue, but I'm glad it's happening. Is there other stuff we want to shout out in the 90s series we were talking? I know one of your favorites, which is also one of mine, is When a Stranger Calls Back.
I love this movie. And this was one of those things that was sort of hard to track down. I feel like there were like a number of weeks in which Elisa and I just were kept emailing each other about like, okay, how do we get When a Stranger Calls Back? Because this was one of my like ride or die titles for this series.
As it should be, yeah.
It's so good. It is, should I describe what this film is? It is the...
Sure, yeah. And it's also, I was gonna refer to it as When a Stranger Calls 2, but in fact, it's technically kind of like When a Stranger Calls 3. Because, you know, there's the... sorry to galaxy
brain. Oh, that's right. That's right. There's The Sitter. Is that what you're referring to? Yeah. Interesting, yes.
Yeah.
So you know who shot The Sitter? Before I get ahead of myself,
Ernest K. Dickerson.
The Sitter is the short film directed by Fred Walton that was became the basis for When a Stranger Calls, his feature from the late 70s starring Carol Kane. The Sitter was shot by Willie Courant, who was a collaborator of Godard, Piala, Gainsbourg. sort of shot some of the most beautiful films of all time and worked with some of the most difficult directors of all time, and then got to America. And I think it was the first thing he made in America was, I'm shooting this Babysitter in Peril short.
Yeah. I mean, hell yeah.
So
I want to shout out to there's a movie I don't know if it's been or is capable of being restored, preserved, rediscovered, but there's a really good Brazilian film, which is like maybe came out before The Sitter. I think it may predate the entire When a Stranger Calls thing. I think the title, you know, which is in Portuguese, translates to like The Angel of the Night or something like that. I want to say it's from like 1972. And, you know, there's like, you can find like a rip of it in various pirate websites if you're a criminal. Which is from like, you know, it's like a U-matic tape. It's like really, really shitty quality, but it's a fucking incredible movie. And it's like, yeah, the whole like babysitter call narrative, but in this Brazilian home, and has a really like blatant but well done like class dynamic and like racial dynamic.
Never heard of this thing.
Someone with power should figure that out.
But I love When a Stranger Calls Back. It's one of my very favorites in this series. I cannot recommend this thing highly enough. Excellent Carol Kane performance. Excellent Charles Durning.
I love a good Charles Durning performance. And yeah, this is one of the best. Yeah.
Yeah.
But what I also love about this movie is it starts with, I think, one of the best iterations of that, like, babysitter stalking phone call, you know, kind of narrative.
This thing we've seen a million times. We're maybe even sick of it at a certain point because it's just so overdone and often quite bad.
Yeah.
And this is just like the masterclass version of that.
Right. And then it kind of goes in another direction mm-hmm. after that. Mm-hmm. And it's an amazing film. Yeah.
It goes in so many directions that you would not expect. It is so full of surprises and scary and upsetting. I think more than anything else, this movie's just upsetting, the things you see in it.
Yeah, yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. And I love that it kind of brings that Tubi energy to the Criterion Channel.
You see those pillar bars on like a 1993 movie.
Oh, yeah, totally. Anything else you guys want to shout out in the 90s series?
I'd like to take a moment to talk about Michael Tolkien's The Rapture.
Here we go. The Caroline alarm just went off. Michael Tolkien's The Rapture, a film that is perhaps the best depiction of aging I've seen in any horror movie. And I also am interested in why you included, I mean, it is a horror film, but it's so different from so many of the films that we've been talking about tonight. It does
There's
have
no Crypt Keeper.
It does have boobs, to be fair. It fits that bill.
How many are we talking?
Plenty, dude. Trust me. You see
more than two?
Have you not seen The Rapture?
I don't think I've seen The Rapture.
Oh my God, John. But,
I mean, you're definitely selling me.
It's so crazy. It's like, such a weird movie.
I guess we're going to need to describe The Rapture to John. I was about to say to describe it to the listeners, yeah. But it's probably worth noting who Michael Tolkien is.
Yeah.
He's probably, at the time, he was, and probably still is, best known as the author of the novel The Player, which was the basis for the Robert Altman film. I believe Michael Tolkien wrote the screenplay for Gleaming the Cube.
So that's the real achievement. I feel like there was a time where
you haven't seen The Rapture,
though.
You say it's the real achievement. You haven't seen The Rapture.
Okay. Fair.
You'll know, like, you're going to watch this movie and it's going to give you like an out of body experience. It's so strange.
Like in the early 90s, New Line Cinema, which was
the vanguard of good taste.
Yes. Major players for horror films in the 80s, also known as the house that Freddy built, because they produced and distributed Nightmare on Elm Street and had a massive hit.
So the house was built by a pederast.
What is it? The bastard child of a thousand maniacs? Is that how Freddy's known? But in the early 90s, New Line gave Michael Tolkien the green light to write and direct his first film. Which stars Mimi Rogers as, do you want to describe the plot of this thing?
Sure can. Mimi Rogers is a woman in her, she's a 30-ish woman who has a 9-to-5 working in the information directory. So back, Grandma Caroline's going to have to tell the kids that back in the day, if you wanted to know a phone number address, you would have to call information. And a real person, usually a 30-ish woman, would pick up the phone and give you that information. And that's
it's kind of like 411. People know 411.
No, I'm telling you, they don't know 411. Really? They don't know the 411. So this is her job all day, every day. This is what she does. And she gets her kicks like swinging. She and this you're a trash guy pick up tourist couples at the airport and they fuck them in a motel. And that's what she does.
Not even a motel. Remember her friend that she does this with owns a furniture store.
Right. They do it in the furniture store.
They go to like the airport bar and pick up David Duchovny and his lady.
Real life sex addict David Duchovny.
This is where the plot turns, right? They like act. It's a great screenplay, obviously. Act one establishes her workaday life. And then at the end of act one, she and her Eurotrash swinging partner pick up David Duchovny.
Scene three of this movie. Like,
really?
4 minutes into the movie, they pick up David Duchovny.
Fuck and then they come back together later or something? Because their relationship intensifies.
What happens is they start sleeping together and they become not just physically intimate, but, you know, just like spiritually intimate in the way. There's this moment where Mimi Rogers says to David Duchovny, like, tell me something about yourself. And he just goes, he's like shirtless in bed. And he goes, I killed a guy once.
Yeah. He's really, really good in this. He's an amazing leading man. He's doing, I killed a guy once. It's not like a far leap from the work that he had done in Red Shoe Diaries too. Like, he's always been a performer who's not afraid to be sexual and objectified. David Duchovny's just like, he's just been hot and sleazy on screen forever. And he brings, as Clyde would attest, a little bit of that chutzpah to his role in The Rapture.
Absolutely.
So they meet in some sex thing. But then the film does take like a very interesting turn, which is that they both become born again, I guess. Like, not in a way that we would recognize today. And that's what I find so interesting about this film, because Michael Tolkien is, like myself, not a Christian, but he is coming at this redemption narrative in a way that's not like a coded as like evangelical or Bible thumping. It really does appeal to a cross section of humanity. So much so that when Mimi Rogers when she catches wind of what's going on and she begins to, she's seduced by it and it becomes this exciting thing, but it fills a void for her. And she comes to realize that so many of her colleagues at the call center that before they had this thing in common were just sort of amorphous NPCs, you might say, in the gaming world. She realizes that they are privy to a remarkable secret, and she becomes privy to it too. And they change their lives.
I want to answer your question that you started at the beginning.
Yeah. Why this movie in the series?
Well, and this is a question that I was wondering myself. I was like, I believe that this fits in as
I do too
as a horror movie, but it was one of the questions that I had was that, are people just gonna drag me for calling this a horror movie? Because, and I rewatched this thing last night not knowing that we were gonna get into it today, but I just, you know, was I think it's a valid question to ask, like,
why is
The Rapture a horror movie? Like, why would I consider this a horror movie? And I think in some ways it's a film in which the fear of the supernatural, the fear of a monster, it's all like replaced with like a fear of God.
It's an existential fear.
Yeah. And it becomes
the greatest fear there is, perhaps.
Yeah. And it horrifying things happen in the movie.
Is that also not the kernel of like every subgenre within horror though? Like all of these things that you create as a boogeyman or some frightening presence, whether it's supernatural or not, whether it's violent and gory or not. Ultimately, what it boils down to is the existential fear, the fear of death or what happens after death.
Sure. I mean, I think one of the most common themes in horror is the return of the repressed.
It's these things
that we're not dealing with, or these things we're trying to hide.
Which comes up in another title that I also wanted to talk about. But go on with what you're going to say.
No, I think what I was going to say is, I don't know. I think that this is an unexpected choice to put in this series, but that's also, I think, maybe why I wanted to do it. And I, you know, for anyone who thinks that I'm way off base by putting The Rapture in this series, I would just say that there is room within 90s horror for films as radically different as The Rapture and Frankenhooker.
Oh boy, you're right. The two genders. There's two kinds of people in this world, The Rapture and Frankenhooker. Getting back to this fear of the repressed. And adjacent to what you had said earlier about the return of Black filmmakers of color to the horror genre in the 90s, Antonia Bird's Ravenous is a movie that is a fantastic 90s horror film, but also an amazing treatise on the unspoken, the unexamined, and the inherently cannibalistic nature of colonial enterprise in the Americas. Mm. Truly a movie about cannibalism in a colonial outpost. It's not subtle about what it's about.
It's not subtle in at the all least about anything.
About anything. And that's what makes it so great. It's a movie that's completely out here, like, you know, with its politics, like, you know, like squarely in front of the audience. But because it's a genre film, and I hate the, you know, to say, oh, it's a genre film, but I mean, because it is, though, like, that's, you know, that's what makes it like such a pleasure, but also like so worthwhile and interesting to engage with. You know, it's not like a dour treatise or a film that's, you know, purely miserabilist. It's scary. And it puts you in the position too of a vulnerability that like a lot of people watching this film from the comfort of their seats are not often meant to feel.
I agree with all that. And I think that the thing about Ravenous is that it is truly maximalist filmmaking.
Absolutely.
In that it's like the lack of subtlety, but also the performances are absolutely playing to the rafters.
Problematic fave Jeffrey Jones. Amazing. I mean, look, whatever. But I mean, an amazing performance.
Yeah. Also, soundtrack by Michael Nyman and Damon Albarn.
Yeah, baby.
I was gonna mention that. Yeah.
Amazing. When I saw that in the credits, because this was, as I mentioned, there are several titles in the series that are that I've seen at the behest of my significant other, who is way more, who used to be a 12-year-old boy.
Yeah, a fellow gamer.
And a fellow gamer. He's not anymore.
And my neighbor.
And your neighbor. Sure. I was hip to this movie, though, and I watched it. I'm sitting here thinking, like, oh, here we go. I'm going to watch a dumb, no offense to all the, you know, 90s horror fans out there, but like, oh, my boyfriend picked another dumb 90s horror movie for us to watch. And then I see Michael Nyman and Damon Albarn. I think, okay, here we go. This movie's going to rock and roll.
The thing about Ravenous is that it starts on, like, the worst note imaginable.
Oh, absolutely.
With those, like, I don't, what are the quote cards at the top?
Oh, God,
but
I don't remember.
There's it does like a serious like literary quote, and then there's like a quote that I don't remember what it was, but it's as like silly as like "you are what you eat" or something, right?
Yeah, it's not an irreverent movie, but I mean it's like a purposefully crude film in a lot of ways too. Like,
but I think there is part of the willful irreverence to it. Yeah, it's a strange offbeat.
It has so many tonally, it's all over the place, but in a way that I find successful, in much the way that like Buckshot from a shotgun is all over the place and manages to like have a maximum blast radius.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's also an interesting film because from what I understand, and I'm not like a expert on this film, but it had like a super complicated production history. Mm-hmm. Where
yeah,
like,
there's definitely a director was fired, and then the Antonia Bird was brought on. Robert Carlyle had worked with her.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it was the biggest shit show and everyone wanted to, you know, tear their hair out, whatever. So it is interesting that it has such a strong perspective, given that it is such a cobbled together.
It's very much like a for hire thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Which studio did that?
Fox 2000.
All right, I was about to say 20th Century Fox. Yeah. It is Fox 2000.
Fox
2000. And I remember the trailer for it.
Wait a minute.
I vaguely remember, I could be wrong, but I feel like the trailer was kind of like extreme, you know, like a little
like
new
red band trailer,
like having like Stabbing Westward in it, like
it's like at the same time concurrent to this. I remember like the Gladiator trailer had Ba with Da Ba on it.
Oh yeah,
really?
Maybe it's like the Damn. Super Bowl trailer or something, but I just remember seeing Russell Crowe and Kid Rock audio.
From around that time too was. Was it Supernova?
The Supernova trailer.
Yes,
with
Steve
Sugar
McFarlane favorite. We have to shout him out on every podcast.
It's true. He does figure out a way to get mentioned on every episode of the show.
But you know, like where, because he's a big fan of that film. But Yeah, it's like cuts to Sugar Ray. Every trailer at that time had the like record scratch.
You know effect. Why, you know, though?
The way, like every trailer now is like, yeah. And then has like a children's choir singing whatever the fuck.
Bring yeah. back the catalog. Thing,
like, at that time was like everything had like a record scratch.
You know why that is too? Because
this ain't your grandma's.
Well, part of it was that
it would be like it oh, is now King Arthur film. And the Knights of the Round Table, and it was the dark time. And then it's like, and then it's like, but then Martin Lawrence, you know.
It's because all these studios were also like in like an umbrella conglomerate with. They all had record labels, and there was a soundtrack that would be put out for all these films that would have songs that were like maybe a little bit of diegetic music in one scene, but they plunked it on there.
Yeah.
You know,
or like, well, what would piss me off is sometimes I would buy the soundtrack to the movie because I liked the song in the trailer, and then it wasn't on the soundtrack or in the movie. Biggest offender being Save Yourself by Stabbing Westward. I don't know if anyone remembers that song, which was in every movie trailer, but no movie soundtracks.
Wow.
That was the one that was like...
Yeah. I know your Stabbing Westward fandom is well established, having done karaoke with you on numerous occasions.
We should talk about the film Unfriended.
Oh, yeah. The movie I watched this week for this show.
Which, so Unfriended is not in 90s horror because it's from 2014.
Yeah, which is such a weird thing to look at 2014 and go.
Distance, huh. 9 years.
Well,
yeah.
A lot of things are kind of the same, but also a lot of things look very different.
We had put it in a series in, I think it was 2017, called The Medium is the Massacre, which was a series of McLuhan-esque horror films. So horror films that deal with various media like the internet, television, film itself, and they were all paired with artist video and experimental film. You know, so obviously there were things in it like Videodrome and
you had Biggest Lunas's Anguish.
Yeah, Poltergeist. Demons. Oh, Demons 1 and 2. Demons 1 being about film, Demons 2 being about television. Oh, Brain Scan.
Brain Scan in that series?
John Flynn's Brain Scan.
I was on the fence about putting Brain Scan in 90s horror, actually.
It's a pretty cool movie. What else? Yeah, Terror Vision was in it. Anyways, and the most recent film was Unfriended. And I believe, I mean, this had to have been like the first repertory film screening of Unfriended on like the planet, because it was only, what, like 3 years after that film came out. But I was talking to Aliza today, who programmed the series, who saw it in that screening, which is interesting because only like two people came out. What was funny is we were really particular about formats with that series, given that it was all about, you know, media. And for some miscommunication, print shipping error, somehow a 35 millimeter print of Unfriended showed up.
That's wild. So it's like that and like Public Enemies are like the two like most recent digital to film distribution films, I guess. I don't know.
Well, Unfriended is crazy because like in 2014,
why is there a print
an all digital
movie?
Film? Why would they have made a print? I think it was probably for drive-ins.
Oh, they had wow. made
it because some at that time, you know, there were probably still drive-ins that could only show 35. What's incredible about watching that film on 35 is that you, in a way, it really foregrounded like the filmness of it in a way, because you see like the softness and the jitter and the grain in a way that you don't notice, because we spend all day looking at these screens now and we live in that environment. And so to see it filtered through a different, you know, analog medium, it was kind of shocking. And in a way, the movie is almost literally illegible.
It's so much of it, of the film, is predicated on these familiar digital interfaces that we recognize from staring at all day.
Yeah.
Right?
It really takes you out to watch it on film. It was kind of crazy.
I watched the film on my TV, and like about 15 minutes in, I thought maybe I should be watching this on a laptop or something, because it was theatrically released. I didn't see it when it came out. I saw Unfriended 2 when it came out, and I thought, I can't believe I'm watching a movie of a computer in a theater. It felt analogous to like what I'm accustomed to. And even though it was released theatrically, you do have to wonder if like the filmmakers, you know, who are still alive. I mean, this movie's less than 10 years old, obviously, you know, like, were they making this with that specific exhibition format in mind of just on your laptop, you know, or knowing that it would have probably its longer second life as a home viewing film?
Yeah.
Well, I think the other bit of context to provide about when this film came out is that it was basically coming out right on like the tail end of the found footage horror craze.
Yeah.
Like basically from like 2008, Paranormal Activity is 2008, 2009. Mm-hmm. And basically from like then up until about 2013, 2014, like basically like every horror movie became found footage.
Which also, to even reach back a little further and call back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, is that too felt like the next iteration of the Blair Witch. It was
absolutely
like Blair Witch came out. There was kind of a wave of found footage films, but it died out. And then it came back with Paranormal Activity. And then, yeah, as you were saying, I think Unfriended definitely fits into the tail end of that while also taking it
it's the next
in a totally new direction. Yeah.
And we're also probably due for, I mean, unless it's going on now and I just don't know because I'm not tuned into horror, but I mean, it would stand to reason that the found footage film is probably due for like yet another revival. Or is it the kind of thing?
I hope not. I'm not ready for that.
Or is it the kind of thing that people are gonna do like more online? I mean, like we're always filming things now versus, you know, back. I mean, people were constantly filming things back then too, but now it's like there's even more of it. So what will the like you know, later into the 21st century found footage film look like when it comes back around, I guess?
I don't want to make it sound like I'm against the kind of movie that Unfriended is. I like Unfriended very much. I like it
more than I thought I would.
I like Unfriended Dark Web even more. I remember also like the movie Searching, which is another one of these screen movies.
Well, Searching is crazy because it's like a period, it's a desktop period piece.
That's right.
I mean, that's fucking
and
nuts.
And that, I remember seeing that movie and, you know, I don't think it's nearly as good as Unfriended, but it was remarkable about it. And I think it's also very incredible about Unfriended is like the, I guess you would say like the verisimilitude, like the desktop, I don't know, realness is really strong. If not, I think I would even say like perfect in these films because we're so used to seeing stuff like, for instance, The Net with Sandra Bullock, where she goes to pizza.net, like, and we see these like
they're
fake
using real
computer
stuff.
Screens.
I mean, they got the buy-in from Skype, from Facebook, from Gmail.
Exactly.
And there's an element of like weird nostalgia to it too, because if you've been on any number of platforms for any length of time, because these things have been around longer than we think, like you recognize different iterations of the interface and how it changes with the technology.
Yeah. And they're updated so regularly and incrementally that the design, like,
it ages
it's
quickly.
Really strikingly different. Yeah. Even when you just look at like watching it in 2017, like 3 years after it came out,
it's like
was already
years,
like
an
ancient thing. So watching it now, like 9 years later,
it's strange.
It's like looks way older than a movie from 1999. So, would,
I mean,
or
this is the thing, because I hadn't seen Unfriended in years, and I rewatched it this week in preparation for this podcast recording. And one of the things that struck me about watching this movie again was that like the style of the teens in it do look dated in a way that I was not expecting.
Yeah, the fashion is like the big change.
But it's also like, here's my question to you guys. Am I reading too far into it? Or do you think that there's like a vaguely sort of like Terry Richardson aesthetic to like how these like teens are like represented?
Well, I think they're just wearing like regular clothes. I mean, the other thing is you can't see too much of what they're wearing, but it all just, I think people have kind of fundamentally dressed the same for the last like 20 years. And I think any kind of like imagined revival of a look is a refusal to acknowledge that the last 20 years have seen a flattening of all aesthetic movements into just a like constant stream of noise and change. What I find weird about this movie though, like, and what part of what makes it kind of dated to me is like the physicality of it. Like they can't go anywhere. They can't, you know, they have like iPhones, but like the iPhone technology is not sophisticated enough that they can move the plot with the things that they need to move the plot with. Like, it's reliant on there being a group chat kind of like element, you know, and the fidelity of the image itself. Like nowadays, I mean, the phones and the camera on the phone, the camera on your computer isn't as sophisticated as, you know, as we'd like to think. But like back then, like the technology was still nascent enough that you would have these kinds of glitches that then become supernatural elements.
Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
a bit, and getting,
that,
and you know,
that also gets into, I mean, they kind of talk about your series with on Metrograph, the EAI series.
Yeah.
And I think there might be a bit, is Takeshi Murata's Silver in yours?
Monster movie.
Yeah. So,
and that's a film that like deliberately uses digital degradation as right. an aspect of storytelling.
Yeah.
Too.
I mean, Takeshi Murata is one of the pioneers, if not maybe like the pioneer of a kind of familiar technique that in a way almost got so played out because it was so like radical when he first started doing it, which is like the data moshing, like the
yep.
specific glitching, like the deliberate glitching.
And
of
it's
the
pervasive now. Like it's
have a buffer.
Yeah, it's recognizable.
Showing up in like Kanye West yeah. music videos and stuff really quickly. And, yeah, he immediately understood the like ghostliness and supernaturalness.
There's something,
like his very first
yeah.
videos to use that all had, you know, there's one with Rambo that's not really supernatural, but there's like Monster Movie. There's one called Untitled Silver, which is he used a DVD of Mario Bava's Black Sunday to create these like glitching effects. And they become kind of like painterly and smudgy, but they also have like that harsh digital aspect. And yeah, that's definitely something that's playing into Unfriended. And I think
it speaks to like a split consciousness that adds another layer of horror to all of these things too.
Yeah. Right?
Because you're accustomed to staring at something that you know isn't real.
Yeah.
That very often creates a simulacra of reality that responds to you in real time through an interface.
This yeah, screen. Yeah.
This is some McLuhan shit, but like stick with it, right?
Yeah.
And we understand that these things are inorganic, they're engineered, they're machines. But when there is some sort of crack in the facade of that machine
mm-hmm.
and it ceases to be infallible, it becomes vulnerable to penetration or to infiltration or breakdown. And there's a possibility that it can cross that meniscus between you at your desk and whatever is behind that screen.
Yeah.
That's the moment of like true panic that sets in,
totally.
Isn't it? And the way that, especially in Unfriended, like I left my notes at home, but when the first girl is killed, because it's a slasher movie, right? It's a teen slasher movie. The first girl is killed and they keep saying, oh, your screen is frozen, you know, like the idea that you've frozen in that, like you've died on your computer and you've died in real life.
yeah.
Like if you die in your dream, you die in real life. The thing that I thought about instantly when that scene happened was how this film is 9 years old. We are like long overdue for the like older version of this movie with people on Zoom. Either
well, that's
like,
funny
you know,
too. How
like,
it's so dated, like that they're on Skype, like.
But like people are on Zoom all the time, right?
Pre-pandemic, everyone used Skype.
Well,
and I don't know what it was like. I mean, I'm sure someone could explain, like, oh yeah, blah blah blah. But like, it was like overnight. Like, no, we're not using Skype anymore. We're on Zoom.
Yeah,
I was like, what?
Skype also plays very heavily in past lives, which I saw earlier this year. It's like a big part of like how they communicate. And seeing the Skype interface is interesting because it is this very rudimentary video conferencing thing. And that's part of why I think people don't use it anymore is that there are other more expensive or better funded things that took its place.
And also like Facebook, I mean, not just to mention the design and et cetera of Facebook, but like, kids don't fucking use Facebook
anymore. The fact that they're all on Facebook is like fascinating to me because I'm thinking, oh my God, they're 18.
But like people did at the time.
That was the
time. Kind of the tail end when it got overrun by like boomers. Also, I think very pre-2016. I feel like 2016, like the election, that was kind of when it was like Facebook is where you're like,
it's where your crazy aunt goes. So earlier today, I was reading a piece in The New Yorker about why the internet isn't fun anymore. And it's a pretty familiar thesis at this point. The idea of this vast, uncharted territory of information and community that has been, you know, deliberately cordoned off and funneled into and corralled into like a series of tubes, to use kind of the Wild West metaphor here. And Corey Seco, the editor of The All, who now works for New York Magazine, cited 2014 as the year that this process began to kind of ramp up in earnest.
Oh, damn. I mean, that's perfect for Unfriended.
No, I know.
It's like a movie about the death of the internet.
It is in a weird way. I mean, like, I keep thinking about, you know, how high stakes it used to be a teenager online and communicating with people, and the fear of, because so much of it is the inciting incident is embarrassing pictures that they post of each other.
Yeah.
And information and secrets that come out, right? And
Which is kind of a classic slasher movie trope as well. If you
I
think
know what
of
you did
like,
last summer.
Yeah, right? Or even like April Fool's Day or whatever. Like that kind of the inciting incident of so many slasher movies is like person is embarrassed. It turns into a tragic death.
Then there's a revenge component in which the secrets of other people
And then people start dying and it's like, did they come back? Is this their ghost? Yeah. You know, and so it. You know, and it works seamlessly into the whole like internet kind of revenge, embarrassment, ostracization.
The digital infrastructure or the user interface stuff in that film that I think aged the best that I thought was very contemporary because it hasn't changed is in the beginning when she's reading the news story about the suicide and there are all these strange kind of like ads for stupid shit in the sidebar.
A
local news website that's just like unnavigable and terrible has not changed one bit. And I think it tells you a lot too about like where the money has consistently been routed in technology, that the local news outlet website still looks like shit today.
Facebook
and Gmail get a fucking facelift every, you know, 12 months or whatever.
My favorite website in that movie is like the website for like, what to do if you get possessed by a demon.
The ghost forums or whatever.
Like, I can't think of many other examples in like a horror movie where someone basically pulls out like the instruction guide.
From a really cool like Web 1.0 forum site too, which is.
And we love like Web 1.0. I mean, we shout out DVD Beaver
all the time
on this podcast. But it's also, it makes you think of how these. We read this context into things when we're searching the web, like whether we're conscious of it or just feel it, like it tells you a certain something when you go to, I mean, just to use a perhaps familiar example, like DVD Beaver, you go to it and you see the like old school HTML 1.0 frames and like it tells you something about the resources behind the site, who's running it. It almost starts to feel like outsider art at a certain point.
It tells you about like the commitment and integrity.
Well, and also,
Dennis Schwartz, Ozu's World movie review.
It also
hasn't changed at all.
It hasn't. Yeah. It implies like a certain level of individual choice in the design and level of buying in from the person making it. Versus something that's become like the internet now, very templatized and controlled and very homogenous.
And you go to a site like ScreenSlate and you're like, this is a $1 billion operation.
Do you regret updating ScreenSlate?
I actually have talked frequently and like this was very much part of the conversations about it at the time was like, if we make this too nice, people are going to think it's a thing that it's not.
Yeah. I often think about what our friend Mike Belandic has said about the internet in that it's basically we are all addicted to the internet. Like this is an addiction. And with every addiction, like sooner or later, there will come a reckoning.
But I think the movie kind of avoids a lot of those like over obvious kind of pitfalls, which, you know, a couple other things about the movie is like it has the weirdest fucking director. Like, I don't think he's directed any other films, and his biggest credit is being he's not like a lead, kind of like a co-star in a spectacle theater classic, Kin Zsa-Zsa.
What?
Which is like a Russian, I would describe it as like the Russian Buckaroo Banzai.
Wait, that guy directed Unfriended?
One of the dudes, like let's say like the third billed guy? From Kin Zsa-Zsa.
Are you kidding me?
Fucking directed Unfriended. And that's like the only other shit he's done.
Wow.
So I'm like, how the
The lore deepens.
How did this happen?
Coming all back around.
I do think it's one of those things where, you know, the producer who's, forget his exact, Timur.
I'm having the same thing in my head right now. The guy who
I don't want to like butcher his name.
The guy did Wanted and Night Watch and Day Watch, right? This Russian guy who came to America in like the mid-aughts.
Yeah. And I remember Night Watch when that film came out was like, it's like the highest grossing film of all time in Russia or something. And like, they brought him over to do, yeah, like Wanted and shit. And he's had, I think, like a pretty successful career in Hollywood, if not necessarily a name director. But he, I think, kind of posits himself and perhaps is like the kind of genius behind the so-called screen life thing. But it is interesting. I mean, given that he is, you know, like kind of older, and definitely the fucking guy who directed the movie is even older than him, I think. They understood like American teenagers and like the milieu of the internet really well in this film, almost eerily. And then not to get too like tinfoil hat conspiracy, but then I'm like, Russians?
Now he's cooking.
You know, like
that third eye is twitching real hard, yeah. John. The history of Russian filmmakers contributing to the American film industry is a lengthy one, too.
Yeah.
Lest we forget. I mean, there's so many.
Perhaps we could tie Unfriended back to the work of Esfir Shub, early Soviet filmmaker known for her montage films.
Yes, there is definitely a bit of a Vertovian.
indeed.
Vertovian grammar of kino,
yeah,
as it were. Many years ago, I programmed a thing with light industry called Photographing a Ghost. Since you're going through your scrapbook, I figured I might as well crack open
shout
mine.
Yourself short, out, yeah.
Gas myself up on my own show.
Yeah,
and
facts.
And the premise of it was films that were made during a time of like, you know, growing spiritualist movement in the late 19th and early 20th century that also coincided with advancements in, you know, photography and filmmaking and electrical engineering in general. And at this time when people were, you know, going through this like spiritualist revival, trying to contact the dead, you know, the means that they would try to, that they employed to try and do it were like through electricity, radio waves, trying to photograph things at different shutter speeds, or the idea that you could capture something that would be imperceivable, things that you couldn't perceive with any of your five earthly senses, shall we say. And every time that there's like a new technology, people immediately go to the sex thing and the ghost thing, the Eros and the Thanos, you know what I mean? All the films that we've cited tonight that are like employing technology to like frighten people or to give them like a heightened sense of fissuring reality, you know, it's like a consistent part of the genre,
yeah,
which I think makes it so so compelling, because it makes the horrible like such a banal part of our daily lives too. Clyde, you look like you've got something real hot cooking.
This is my question, because you're making this point about how technology has been used to try to capture ghosts, or also
show boobs,
show sex.
The two most important things.
Has anyone yet made a film about using this technology to have sex with a ghost?
Whoa.
Oh, I'm sure. Wait, I mean, I should definitely know this. I mean,
like, can you have like, sex with a ghost?
Like, I'm talking about like what is that John Huff movie? Like the Legend of Hell House.
Yeah.
They're trying to capture it, but there's like, you know, like that kind of movie, except about
that's like
ghosts.
A underrated.
Okay, I well, think, wait, actually, film,
yeah. I think that movie rocks. I really like that movie.
I got one for you, which is a movie that employs both technological advancements to track down ghosts and also features like that kind of permeability, which is The Entity.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, that's a good,
like, that's absolute all timer.
I love that movie. That is a movie that uses technology to get a ghost to stop raping.
A ghost rapist. Yeah.
Which also memorably figures into the great experimental film Outer Space by Peter Cherkasky.
Wow.
As featured in the Screen Slate series, The Medium is the Massacre.
Wow. You know what's so funny? is that all of these things have so much overlap and we're constantly cross-referencing them.
The question I want to ask is, because we've all spent so much time on the internet, but especially from the pandemic, spent way too much time of our time on the internet and forced to do this. Do people want to watch a movie about Zoom? Like, or like, have we?
Do they
like,
want to watch a movie about Skype? I mean, you know, it's like a.
But at least like, Skype is, I almost feel like that's like one, that's like at least like of several years removed at this point. That's like,
so maybe they will in several years.
Antiquated, but with like Zoom, we all spend so much time on Zoom for our jobs. Do people want to watch
these
movies? I fucking hate it, but also like if you, let's say 15 years from now, want to make a film that accurately represents this point in time, like, yeah, you're gonna
have to use Zoom.
On Zoom. Well, Clyde Folley, thank you for coming back to ScreenSlate HQ and talking to us about 90s horror. I hope you'll come back next year and talk to us about Zero's horror.
John Derringer, horror. Thank you for having me. Caroline Gollum, thank you for having me. This has been a pleasure. Love being here. Come here whenever. Just call. You know where I live.
Thanks for listening to the Screen Slate podcast. 90s horror, pre-code horror, art house horror, and high school horror are all streaming this month on the Criterion channel. You can also subscribe to our newsletter and follow our socials for info about special giveaways we're doing with the Criterion channel. This episode was edited by AJ McKeon and made possible by our Patreon members. Visit patreon.com/screenslate to support. Like I said up top, ScreenSlate's basically a labor of love, and this is our primary means of covering costs, paying honoraria to writers and editors, and just keeping everything going. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast. I've been teasing this next episode for a while, and I swear to God it's going to happen. Our next guest is going to kill me because it's not online yet, but the one and only Richard Hell, poet, punk legend, man about town, will be on our next episode, which should be up any day now. So keep your eyes and ears open for that one. Until then, stay spooky, have a great October, and we will catch you soon.